Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. The State of Texas versus $217,590 from B County. CMH Holmes versus Kirk Bannon from Montgomery County. And Joanne Pustajowski and others are individually as representative of the heirs and estate versus Pittsburgh Corning Corporation and others from Bexar County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and complete the arguments before the noon break. These arguments are being recorded by the clerk of our court, and you may purchase a tape of an argument for a nominal fee. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in State versus Currency.
May it please the court, Mr. Brian Johnson will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'm Brian Johnson, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Texas. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here this morning and appear before this court. It's also an honor to be representing the petitioner of the State of Texas today in this cause. The petitioner has been looking forward to this opportunity to come before this court to ask this court to reinstate a judgment won at trial. I tried this case in the trial court. I know what this trial consisted of. The facts of the case, the facts of the evidence are set out in my brief. The trial consisted of overwhelming evidence that the money in this case, the subject of this lawsuit, was dope money. I'm going to use that term, dope money. I apologize, it's a little colloquial. One, because it's a lot easier and shorter than saying the illicit proceeds of illegal narcotics transactions. Also, because it's the term used by Mr. Olvera himself, he's the respondent in this case, when he described the money to the police on April the 3rd, 1994, when the money was discovered. The evidence in this case was so overwhelming that Mr. Olvera chose to assert his Fifth Amendment privilege when deposed in this matter to any questions of substance concerning that money. It also was so overwhelming, Mr. Olvera chose not to appear and testify at this trial, or even to appear in the courthouse, or even at his home, so he could be subpoenaed by the state to the trial.
Counsel, we're not as concerned, are we, with the evidence of the connection between the defendant and the drug money as we are about the consent issue, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. The three issues that we have briefed, the first being that of consent, the first two are independent of each other, but they do dovetail, they do concern the legality of the search.
What is the standard of review that we should apply in reviewing the consent issue?
I believe that what the court should be looking for is the totality of circumstances regarding the voluntariness of the consent that Mr. Olvera gave.
And in reviewing the totality of the circumstances, what standard should we use?
Well, there's a standard that is put forth in the appeals court opinion, which I believe is an incorrect standard that they use. They throw that in on after conducting an erroneous analysis of fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine. They apparently used a reasonable doubt standard, employing a standard of review for criminal cases. They put that in writing in their opinion. I believe that to be incorrect.
Well, the totality of the circumstances does arise from the criminal law.
Yes, it does. In the criminal law that would apply to this case, and understandably, this is a civil proceeding, a civil trial growing out of a criminal law enforcement event, the seizure of the money. I think the case law, both the United States Supreme Court and the case law that Texas has followed, the cases cited in our brief, which would ask the would be the totality of circumstances to look at all of them. The appeals court apparently decided to...
But how much deference is the appellate court required to give to the trial court's determination on consent?
Oh, great. The consent is it's been determined in Texas to be a question of fact. Give great deference to the trial court's finding.
Well, how do we deal then with the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals decision in Guzman, where they have stated that the standard, as I understand it, is just a continuum along the way, and if there's not factual determinations that underpin the evaluation of totality of circumstances, then the review is de novo? which would mean no deference to the trial court.
Well, I understand that Guzman, though, still gives the trial court great deference as far as judging the credibility of witnesses. Here, the only witnesses that testified were the trooper, our state trooper, and, of course, we also had the videotape of the entire event offered by the state. I think the trial court would have been in the best position and should be given great deference for its determination and its findings of fact and the issue of credibility of that testifying police officer and what the court saw in the videotape and made its own determination.
What standard do the federal appellate courts use in reviewing civil forfeiture determinations when a consent issue or voluntariness arises in the context?
It would be the totality of the circumstances.
I understand that you look to the totality of the circumstances, but I'm talking about how much deference is given. Is it an abuse of discretion review? Is it a de novo review? Is it something in between? What standard do the
I'm here to submit to this court that it should be a deference to the trial court because it hinges on the credibility of the witnesses that the trial court is able to see.
Is that what the federal courts do?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have any cites for that, any citations to federal authority?
I'm afraid I'm not a great person at reciting citations. I will rely on what's cited in my brief.
Thank you.
I believe the Schneckloff case is one that should be dispositive of this.
Can you point to any evidence in the trial court? For example, you refer to the officer's testimony. I would assume that we've got the videotape here as part of the record, so we could review that to know, but the trial court would be in no better position to determine credibility from the videotape. But as far as the officer's testimony in the trial court, what evidence or testimony can you point to that would involve the trial court's determination of the officer's credibility live in the court?
Well, the officer testified on direct and was cross-examined extensively about exactly what happened in the conversation with Mr. Olvera standing there behind his truck. That is also the exact same conversation that's captured on the video.
And so none of that's disputed. The facts are not in dispute.
It is not disputed. There's no uncontroverted facts that were brought out in this trial.
So if the facts are undisputed, we're not really talking about judging credibility of a witness. We're talking about pure application of law to undisputed facts.
Well, in a way, but I think in a way that's almost it would disadvantage the plaintiff in this with Mr. Olvera not coming to court and testifying to say, I really didn't consent. I didn't mean to consent when I said, I guess so, to Trooper Moore. In a way, I'm put at a disadvantage by not having him come to court because the Court of Appeals is I guess, gone inside his head to decide that or to assume that he didn't understand the question or he was not consenting. The testimony at trial court was Trooper Moore testifying to the judge that I asked the man the question. I heard his response. I understood that to be an affirmative response. And then we rely on his credibility and the court issuing a finding of fact that he found Trooper Moore along with the other state's witness to be credible. Also, Trooper Moore was cross-examined about a statement he later makes, which is on the videotape, when the dog handler arrives. And that's set out in our brief as well. When the dog handler arrives, Trooper Moore says something to the effect, this man doesn't want his truck searched. And Trooper Moore testified that what he meant there was, he has given me affirmative consent to search the truck, but he's not enjoying this. He doesn't want this to happen, but he has given me affirmative consent to search his truck. And I think that's very understandable because
was that testimony in the record, or is that an inference that you're saying the statement's capable of?
No, that's Trooper Moore explaining that statement during trial, both on direct and cross-examination. Because that is a statement that might lead you to believe that Trooper Moore really doesn't think he's been given affirmative consent, but he explained that statement meaning, no, I was given affirmative consent when I asked Mr. Olvera, can I have your permission to search the trailer and the cab? That's the front part of the truck. And Mr. Olvera says, I guess so. I understood that to be affirmative consent that he gave me. Later on, that offhand remark that I make to the dog handler didn't mean I had changed my mind or I didn't believe that. It just means that Mr. Olvera wishes he was probably somewhere else because he knows that I've got a chance of finding this dope money that's hidden in his truck.
Do you agree that we apply the clear and convincing standard to review the evidence of consent?
I believe that I wish I were a better appellate lawyer to answer questions like that. I think the reasonable doubt standard that's put out in the opinion right now, I think it's just clearly wrong. I would think a clear and convincing standard based on the totality of the circumstances, I think that is the important thing, rather than to zero in on one circumstance.
But you'd agree that based on the totality of the circumstances, there must be clear and convincing proof that it was voluntary?
Yes. Yes.
Would you talk for a minute about your second point, probable cause for the search, even if there's no consent, particularly address the credibility of Nemo with the dog?
Your Honor, the only evidence put forward by the respondent in this case was to bring an expert who had never seen the dog, worked with the dog, or handled the dog himself. He was able to get on the witness stand and give opinions. Tactically, we did not even cross-examine this person because he had no direct facts, if anything, and never on the record ever said that this dog, whose name was Nemo, never said that Nemo was not alerting to the odor of marijuana on April the 3rd, 1994. He never testified to that because I'm going to assume because that is true. And as the Justice Searden pointed out in his dissent in the 13th Court of Appeals, in this case, the dog was right. There was marijuana, traces of marijuana found in that truck as a result of the search. There was also $217,590 of dope money, which could have also been tainted with the odor of marijuana. We, of course, know that now, but no one ever said that the dog was wrong in this case. In fact, we know from the fact the dog was, in fact, right. Now, it is Texas law, following U.S. Supreme Court law, that the alert of a trained detection dog will establishes probable cause to search a vehicle. The vehicle may be moved to a location such as a police station to complete that search absent the obtaining of a search warrant.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I deserve my time. Thank you.
The court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
Thank you. Good morning.
Please the court. Mr. G. Rudolph Garza, Jr. will present argument from the respondent.
The review of the findings of fact in this case, which we contend is a civil quasi-criminal case, is not and should not be the traditional civil case restricted standard of don't overturn the verdict, the jury finding, or the judge finding, unless those findings are so against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence as to be clearly unjust, wrong and unjust. This is not, as Your Honor has pointed out, a disputed evidence case. This is not a some evidence versus no evidence type of review case. This case is not like a negligence case, where you may have to challenge or there's brought to the court specific acts of negligence or whether there was sufficient evidence to support that finding or other types of items of findings such as damages, etc. The issue in this case is whether the respondent gave legally effective consent to search.
But what burden of proof did the Court of Appeals establish?
The Court of Appeals, I believe, accepted the burden of proof under a de novo review that the evidence should be positive and unequivocal, first of all, and that it should be done by clear and convincing evidence.
Did the Court of Appeals use a criminal burden of proof as opposed to a civil burden of proof?
It has to be a criminal Court of Appeals, I submit, because the essence...
What's your legal basis of that?
I'm sorry?
What's your legal support for that?
The legal support is, number one, the statute itself. Article 59.03 talks about the legality of warrants, the legality of consent, the legality of searches, perforce under the criminal jurisprudence. That's the only area of law that brings those issues into sharp focus. And therefore, we have the anomalous situation here where, yes, the case is prosecuted civilly, but it's full of criminal law implications. By necessity, it has to be full of criminal law implications.
Let's talk about
and that's what's wrong with the state's position in this case.
Let's talk about the statute for a minute that you just referred to, 5903... B1 says that the owner of the property must knowingly
consent.
Now, I believe that the trial court and the Court of Appeals spoke in terms of voluntary consent when the statute says knowingly. Is there a difference?
I'm not sure the Court of Appeals went strictly on voluntary. You're talking about, of course, the in-bank ultimate decision of the court.
Yes.
Well, I think they did not find that Mr. Olvera had voluntarily consented or knowingly consented, but rather that his consent was not shown by clear and convincing evidence to have been positive and unequivocal. Am I answering your question?
Well, I just The Court of Appeals opinion seemed to speak in terms of the criminal cases that deal with voluntary consent.
Yes, it does, absolutely.
And they use the voluntary term that is typical for criminal cases.
Those terms I find, and mostly in criminal cases, are interchangeably used in many opinions.
Right, yes. And is there any significance to the fact that the statute speaks in terms of knowingly as opposed to voluntarily?
I would submit that the significance is that it still must be the equivalent of legally effective consent. Knowingly consent, although it doesn't say the individual must give legally effective consent, that's what it must mean.
So you believe that knowingly and voluntarily are synonymous?
To a large degree, yes.
Yes. What makes this consent not knowing consent or voluntary consent?
Because it wasn't legally effective. The I guess so is inherently unequivocal, obviously. The issue here is not whether Mr. Olvera said, I guess so. That's a conceded point. Obviously, he said, I guess so. The issue is not, is there evidence to support the proposition that Trooper Moore believed that he was obtaining consent. The issue is, upon examination of the totality of the circumstances as a mixed question of law and fact, was there a proper showing by clear and convincing proof of positive and unequivocal consent?
What would that look like?
That would have to look like a lot better than what it looks like in this case. I mean, I could hypothesize, I could give you a lot of hypotheses, Your Honor. I mean, every case turns on its facts, especially in this area of search and seizure. And that's why the court very much has to employ a totality of the circumstances, de novo review, unless there is precisely disputed factual issues, which again, they're not involved here.
The state argues that the Court of Appeals, and you just did in your argument as well, focuses too much on one aspect, and that is trying to infer or interpret his statement, I guess so. And that in doing so, it did not look to the totality of the circumstances. Did you respond to that argument?
I disagree that the court did not take into account the totality of the circumstances.
You agree, though, the Court of Appeals decision turns on that, on interpreting that one statement.
It placed emphasis on that, but it also laid out in the various footnotes, the various factors that the court apparently was recognizing that the court should consider, and I would submit did consider, in making its conclusion based on a de novo review.
Do you disagree with the authority cited by the state in its brief, citing the Texas cases that list the various factors that go into the evaluation?
No, I don't. No, I think we agree on that. In fact, one of the things I had written here to say to you this morning was that the state seems to recognize these authorities, but doesn't accept them. It doesn't want to accept their applicability to the case at hand.
And I understand your view is that the trial court is entitled to no deference in its determination.
In this situation, deference, but under a de novo review. In other words, I don't think it's entitled to the deference that the cases speak of when the determination turns on credibility, turns on an observation of demeanor.
Well, isn't that part of what's at issue here, if what's necessary is for the fact finder to look at the videotape of this instance of your client saying, I guess so, to the trooper at the scene where the trooper is searching the truck? Isn't that a credibility determination, or isn't that part of what a fact finder has to do, to infer from the totality of the circumstances what he meant?
I agree that it's part. But I don't think that I think in this case, the Court of Appeals de novo determination is correct, that the trial court erred in deeming that under the totality of circumstances for the state to have met its burden by showing by clear and convincing proof that the consent was positive and unequivocal. That's what the state refuses to face in this case. It won't talk too much about meeting the burden of establishing the consent by positive and clear evidence, and that the consent was convinced that was positive and clear.
Let me ask you this. Other than Mr. Olvera not knowing that he did not have to give the consent, what other factors lead to the conclusion that his consent was not voluntary?
Prolonged detention by the trooper.
How long?
I think it was something in the order of initially 20 minutes and then another 15 minutes or so, as I recall.
Was he detained?
Why is that prolonged?
Yes, he was detained. He was absolutely detained. He was not free to leave.
Why is that prolonged? He was inspecting the truck.
Because he had...
The trooper had the right to do.
He had satisfactorily completed the, the initial search of the safety features of the vehicle, and then still persisted. He wanted to see if he could get the consent. That's a ploy that's always used nowadays by law enforcement officers, to see if we can get consent. That erases all other illegalities we may do.
But didn't he get the consent before he inspected the truck for those 20 minutes? He got the consent before he began inspecting the truck, did he not?
No. Our position is he was inspecting from the very get-go, ostensibly, initially, for just this vehicle safety inspection purpose, which is legitimate. But he admits, and it's in the record, that he was there for drug interdiction purposes. That was the foremost thing in his mind, drug interdiction purposes. He just uses the ploy, the legal ploy, if there's a basis for it. Here there was a missing mud flap. Yeah, he was properly pulled over. We never disputed that. But then the officer continues to exploit that. Getting back to whoever asked the question about the delay, all of these factors came into account. The expression by the officer to the dog handler when he got there, this guy doesn't want to get searched.
But now the detention, he knew he could leave, correct?
Mr. Olivera didn't know he could
leave. Well, but Officer Moore testified that he was free.
Mr.
And if we're to give that testimony credibility, as you say, why can't we assume that he was free to leave?
Well, yes, you may give that credibility, but it still doesn't take the spade off the hook.
Okay, but it does away with the delay argument and the detention.
Well, no, it's still part of the picture. We say that it's still part of the picture, though, in terms of the totality of the circumstances, that finally the Corpus Christi court said the state didn't meet its burden. They didn't use written forms for consent like he had. He admitted, I didn't use them. That's
what
another ploy.
What would be the difference if he had signed?
I think on behalf of the respondent, we would be harder pressed to say, well, we didn't really mean to sign that.
How would that change the totality of the circumstances, an oral consent as opposed to signing your name on form?
Well, obviously, if he signed something, he hopefully would have read it, maybe more deliberately, shown more than just acquiescence to the request for search, which we say here it was mere acquiescence to his request. I think when somebody has to sign something, presumably they'll read it. That would have been on the tape. I'm speculating, but hopefully that would have been on the tape, and then maybe we would be in a worse position to argue the not giving a valid consent in this case.
When weighing the totality of the circumstances, do you agree that we can consider Mr. Olivera's absence in the courtroom, his failure to come in and dispute and testify against anything that the state was presenting?
No, I don't agree with that. I think the state's burden is throughout in this case.
You agree he doesn't have any Fifth Amendment rights he can assert in a civil matter, right?
No, not necessarily, Your Honor.
Inferences can be drawn from his asserting Fifth Amendment rights?
In certain contexts, I agree, though, that, yes, adverse inferences can be drawn from that in the proper context. As to issue number two, on behalf of the respondent, we welcome, I think, the opportunity this honorable court may take to write on the issue of dog alerts and their required reliability to provide a basis for probable cause to search. In other words, as stated in our brief, we are willing to throw the gauntlet of what appears to be a case of first impression to this court to establish and declare what the test should be as to the reliability of dog alerts in the context of this quasi-criminal civil forfeiture case. By joining the state and asking this court to examine the issue of whether the trial court erred in holding that there was a reliable dog alert in this case, which provided the basis or could provide the basis for probable cause to continue searching the respondent's vehicle. As we point out in our brief, the issue of the reliability of the so-called drug detecting dogs is becoming increasingly questioned throughout the United States in both federal and state courts. The Rodriguez case cited in our brief is the only case I was able to find that somewhat lays out some of the conditions that should be met in order for probable cause to be established on the basis of a dog alert. The dog trainer team involved in this case, the case at bar, was, as our witness expert testified, quote, very grossly unreliable. It had an 82%+ false response rate, which conversely meant it had at best a 17 to 18% success or accuracy rate. We, the respondent, made the trial record on this because the state didn't even want to touch the issue after we took depositions and made discovery of the dog's utilization records, which incidentally also was shown to have been omitted 25% of the time. Surely this honorable court will not give a blind carte blanche to the use of so-called drug detector dogs. That is, surely the court will require acceptable minimal training and demonstration of current competence through proper periodic proficiency training and other criteria, all of which would be subject to scrutiny and examination by adversely affected parties such as the respondent in this case. We did indeed make an extensive use of discovery and deposition practice in defending this case, and we made, I submit, a convincing and irrefutable case of this dog handler team's total unacceptable reliability.
I'm not sure while that's important, if the issue is consent to search, and the officer had already partially searched the vehicle in the first place, and what the dog does is give him an incentive to be a little more detailed in the search.
But I'm not understanding the question, Your Honor.
Well, if the issue here is the consent to search, and that's what we're to decide, what difference does it make how far or how near the search was and what the dog did or didn't do on the issue in this case?
I wish the Court of Appeals, I wish the trial court had broached that issue because we developed that extensive, chose not to do so. So that's why only the issue of consent is in front of this court, because that's what the Court of Appeals, Appeals Court, focused its review on the consent issue, and then
But I guess the point being, if we decide that we agree with you that there was no consent, that's the end of the whole case, and we don't have to talk about the dog.
At this point, except the state is asking you, and we'll join the state if the court sees fit to examine the dog issue, because I think that's really important for the jurisprudence of this state. Admittedly, though, it hasn't been as well developed in the courts below as one would like for this court ultimately then to pass adequate and important review of those issues.
If we were to agree with the state in this case on the consent issue, then is this case over, or are there any issues that need to further be considered by the Court of Appeal?
Well, I would hope that maybe that will, if you were to reverse the Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi, and probably we would lose, because the dog issue was not raised. Although maybe not, and thinking about that, and I hadn't thought about that, Your Honor, frankly. I hope we still have preserved the dog issue.
The Court of Appeals mentioned some issues that were not decided, and my question to you is the consent issue in this case dispositive so that no other issues need be considered?
I don't know. I just haven't thought of the implications of that. Very interesting question. I'm sorry. I'm not sure what the answer would be, or ought to be. With respect to the third ground of error that the state has brought, the Corpus Christi Court's use of 44.2 as a standard of review under the rules of appellate procedure for in the finding of a reversible error, I submit that it used the criminal law standard of 44.2. because it was dealing with constitutional error. And that's what 44.2 first of all addresses, is that if constitutional error is found that is subject to harmless error rule analysis, then the court must reverse unless the court determines beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to, as the rule leads, to the conviction or punishment. In this case, as the court said, to the rendition of an improper judgment. That's one of the anomalies here that perhaps this court can address as to how the proper alleged errors should be evaluated by the courts in these quasi-criminal civil forfeiture cases.
Mr. Garza, let me ask you this. Was this gentleman ever charged and tried, convicted of the transportation of drugs and money in this case?
I don't believe so. I know he was never tried for such a case. He may have been initially filed against, but not indicted. I can tell you, not indicted, but I don't recall, and I was the trial lawyer, I just don't recall whether he was ever at least initially charged with the crime by complaint, and maybe he wasn't even that.
So there's no criminal conviction underlying this forfeiture?
That's correct.
This is, he was found in possession of this money, and the state has brought a claim to that money that he has not, other than filing an answer to, apparently didn't come to trial to contest.
Well, he wasn't physically present, but I was there every moment for him. And, of course, he submitted to deposition. He was not there physically during the trial. He was amenable to process. The state never compelled his appearance. The evidence was fully developed. The record is voluminous. I think the issues were all very well raised and aired.
But is the state's rights to forfeiture affected in any way by the fact that there is no criminal conviction?
No, not at all. In fact, the statute itself says criminal conviction is not necessary in order for a proper forfeiture to take place.
Does it raise a question, though, on what standard to apply to the burden of proof where the government is taking personal property?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the constitutional issues of the search and seizure involved relate to whether it's going to ultimately affect personal freedom or the deprivation of property. I think they're both constitutionally significant and entitled to the full constitutional protections afforded by not only the federal, but of course the state constitution, as well as Article 38.23 of the Code of Criminal Procedure, which is another item that the state complains about. That the court utilized 38.23, that of course provides statutorily that any illegal evidence obtained shall not be used against a person in a criminal case. I submit that because this is, again, quasi-criminal, that was properly employed. Another interesting issue for the court to ponder.
In your research, have you come across any cases that talk about that issue in the forfeiture context of what the standard in the civil forfeiture ought to be with respect to the nature of the government taking the property? Or
one case that is, I think is very well written, is by the Austin Court of Appeals, which I believe is, I can't remember the last name. It's not cited in the brief, and it does talk about the exclusionary rule in civil cases, and Vada versus Sharp, 880 Southwest 2nd, 844, which involved a tax collection matter on dope under the tax statutes of Texas, and the issue there was dealt with the Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule, and Justice Kidd of the Austin Court writes what I think is a very well drafted, presented opinion discussing all the features, starting with the history of the exclusionary rule, and then the exclusionary rule in civil proceedings, and the test of Wolf v. Commissioner, which is a Sixth Circuit case, and essentially in Vada v. Sharp, the court concludes that the court should have suppressed the evidence because of the backdoors that it applied.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready for rebuttal.
Mr. Johnson, in trying to decide whether a civil standard or a criminal standard applies to the evidence that's before the court, should the court take into consideration the nature of what gives the government the right to take this property? If a policeman stopped the van for a missing mud flap, would the state, even if they had a statute, would the state have the right to take the property in a civil proceeding, not criminal, and just only have to produce a preponderance of the evidence? That sort of thing?
Yes, to answer your earlier question, Chapter 59 Code of Criminal Procedure, the statute that controls here that our petition is based on, establishes probable cause as the standard. that the state, that the state's burden to prove that the property, by probable, there's probable cause that the property is contraband as defined in that chapter. Does that answer your question? It is statutorily set out as probable, as a standard of probable cause in our chapter 15.
Under the criminal, under a criminal burden of proof for probable cause.
Right? Yes. I would not argue with that. The Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution and the exclusionary rule of the Fourth Amendment applies to these cases. That, and I think also statutorily, Chapter 59 sets out or does state that evidence obtained illegally shall not be used in this kind of a trial.
So if you move to the knowing consent or voluntariness of consent, which is another aspect of that, perhaps that requires a higher burden, a clear and convincing standard, maybe under the criminal view of the totality of circumstances, under the same rationale, before the government can take the property.
Well, I don't think there's a, I don't think there's any greater burden than what is set out in the cases that the Texas criminal courts follow on any issue of consent, or any case where there's an issue of consent. I think the burden is always going to be the same. I don't think there's any difference to this being a civil asset forfeiture trial than there would be if it was a criminal trial and the defendant were personally on trial, indicted, and the issue was consent. I think the burden should be the same in both of those cases.
Let me ask you the same question about the wording of the statute. I believe that the U.S. Supreme Court has said there is a difference between knowingly and voluntarily consenting, and that knowing consent is a higher standard than voluntary consent. Do you think there's any significance to the fact that the legislature chose to put knowingly for consent rather than voluntary in the civil statute? Did they intend a higher level?
I'm not aware of any interpretation of that part of Chapter 59. I'm not.
You want us to say that the Court of Appeals was wrong in its reevaluation of the evidence concerning voluntary consent?
Well, I believe, and this goes back to the earlier question about the Guzman case. The Guzman...
Hold on a second. I'm going somewhere with this. You want us to hold the Court of Appeals was wrong in its reanalysis of the evidence, including that there was no voluntary consent, correct?
Yes, and overturned, yes.
What kind of rule do you want us to establish? We can't just say, okay, the Court of Appeals was wrong. We have to establish a rule that would apply not only in this case, but in all cases, with regard to appellate court review of trial court findings with regard to voluntary consent. What rule do we establish that shows that the Court of Appeals violated in this case?
I think the rule to follow is one that's already been clearly established. I think the rule to follow is not to disturb the findings of fact of the trial court without, unless they are against the great weight of preponderance of the evidence, as to be performing an injustice. I know I'm not stating that rule very well, but I think that's the rule to follow. That's what we're arguing here. That's even not specific to this case. I think that's the greater issue here, whether or not the appeals court should come in and, absent any evidence to the contrary, come in and disturb the findings of fact of, based upon plaintiff's evidence, unless they are against the great weight of preponderance of the evidence, as to do an injustice. And I think if you look at this case specifically, there's no injustice to be done, and there is no great weight of preponderance other than plaintiff's evidence that was put on, which the court found to be credible.
But you're arguing a factual sufficiency standard, essentially.
I'm sorry?
Are you arguing a factual sufficiency standard?
I think we're very factually sufficient.
Well, how does this court have jurisdiction to review what the Court of Appeals did with the standards of factual sufficiency?
I'm afraid I don't know how to answer that question.
Do we, I understand you're attacking the Court of Appeals opinion because they failed to look at the totality of the circumstances. They only looked at this one issue on consent. If we were to agree with you on that, do we then look at the totality of the circumstances, or do we remand the Court of Appeals to review the totality of the circumstances, considering all the other elements?
I think that's a very good question for me to try to answer. I'm afraid I don't know how to answer that either. I think on remand, from their opinion, it appears they were focusing and they were giving great, or they were putting great weight on that one issue. Whether or not they, to remand to them, I'm not sure would do any good, but I'm afraid, again, I don't know how to answer that question either. I think that I think all the circumstances should have been weighed equally. I do want to respond to, there was certainly an earlier question about the issue of consent. I think if this court were to find that the trial court's rulings, finding the fact that it was affirmative and voluntary consent, I think that does end this case. And just briefly with the rest of my time, I would like to address the third issue would be, I think, the erroneous analysis of the fruit of the poisonous tree. And as set out in my brief, I believe what was done was a crude but-for test, and that is, but for this event happening, if this event had not happened, all these other events would not have happened. That's a but-for test. I would ask y'all based on the cases, all the cases that are cited say, they all stress, do not do that kind of analysis. It's more of a proximate cause analysis. It is, if this first event happened, did it cause the second event? The first event being the finding of the money, the second event that we're talking about in this case being the statements that Mr. Olvera made to Detective O'Burke several hours later that day. Now, it's easy to see that the money could have been found and Mr. Olvera not made those statements to Detective Burke. He could have refused to answer them. He could have given different statements. He could have told Detective Burke he was blissfully ignorant of the money. So looking at it at a causal nature, which is what the proper analysis proved the poisonous tree, those statements should have been admissible, and they should have been treated as statements against interest by a party. They would have been clearly admissible in this trial, as they were, that the trial judge heard them. And they're obviously very very dispositive of the case, as Mr. Olvera admitted that it was dope money and what he was doing with it. And I ask this court to see the error in that type of analysis. Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. We will take a break.